Welcome to the Inner Hoe Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, pansexual, non-monogamish, non-binary-ish feminist hoe living in New York City whose pronouns are they, them, she, and her. And I'm joined by...
Akua, pronouns she and her, your favorite demi-omnisexual mental health professional cat mom.
Oh no.
Speaking of cat momness, those are my babies. All the things, black, ho-ish, and everything else, yes.
Not you being a cat mom and just forgetting about the fact that you're a real mom.
That
too. I'm gonna tell Dave. All right. Every episode of the Inner Hoe Uprising works like this. Myself and my lovely rotating co-hosts talk about sex, love, and dating as it pertains to current events in the world, our lives, and yours. And occasionally, we hit you with interviews with insightful folks or do deep dive episodes on a topic of our choice. And occasionally, it's just something like in between all of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this week is.
Yeah.
this episode, biology professor. Is the pun landing? Professor Akua and history professor Sam school you. Classes in session starting now. We're talking about the history of STIs and mass incarceration, gay kitties, interesting things people used to do to their balls, polyamorous birds, and much more.
And if you would like to follow along with conversation had here on this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag InnerHoeUprising or tweet us at InnerHoeUprising without the G on Twitter. We're also at Inner Hoe Uprising on Instagram and Facebook.
All right, let's dive in. What's the sound that happens before school starts? Bring. I don't know. I haven't been in school in forever. 15 years. Yeah.
It's some type of bell.
Okay, let's get into our first segment. This is a new segment. It's called Hoe History, and it is a moment in historical hoedom or that pertains to sex and sexuality. So let's talk about the 1918 Chamberlain Con Act, which is a lot more interesting than it sounds because it doesn't sound very interesting yet, but I promise. All right, so the Chamberlain Con Act of 1918 is a federal U.S. law passed July 9th, 1918. It is a cancer. The law implemented a public health program that came to be known as the quote-unquote American plan, whose stated goal was to combat the spread of STIs. So the Chamberlain Con Act gave the government the power to quarantine any woman suspected of having an STI. A medical examination was required, and if it revealed an STI, this discovery could constitute proof of prostitution. The purpose of the law was to prevent the spread of STIs among U.S. soldiers. During World War I, the American plan authorized the military to arrest any woman within 5 miles of a military containment. If found infected, a woman could be sentenced to a hospital or a quote-unquote farm colony until cured. Initial thoughts about that.
How was a farm colony going, like, is planting corn going to help with this STI? No, I need medical treatment. You can't just put me to work. So you're really just imprisoning me for forced labor because...
I don't know if the farm colony was actually them farming. I don't know what that is, to be very, very fair. But the imprisonment is not assisting anyone in curing any sort of STI. Yes, you're right. What stuck out to me about this is like the overlap between the militarism of the United States and just like policing people's sexualities. Mm-hmm. And over the summer, I learned this interesting fact. It's illegal to cheat on your spouse in the military.
Okay. Wait a minute now.
Work through it.
Is it illegal as the person who has signed the contract with the military to cheat on your spouse?
Yes. Okay. Yes. The person in the military.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Thank you. Interesting. All right.
Okay. Yeah. So let's continue about with that little aside. Let's continue about the Chamberlain Con Act and the American plan that followed. Mm-hmm. So this is pulled from Wikipedia, and then I'm going to pull from some other sources. But training camps for World War One soldiers were, this is like about like how this came to be, right? Mm-hmm. So training camps for World War One soldiers were large and thought to have a culture of quote unquote excessive alcohol consumption and illicit sexual activities with local women. Mm-hmm. So that culture in general mixed with rumors of widespread STIs among militaries in Europe, because, you know, Europe was in World War One before we joined World War One, inspired the creation of the Commission on Training Camp Activities, which sought to investigate the sexual and moral cultures of these training camps. So some people were sent, they wrote a whole report, the report was written, and that's what made them want to implement, like, measures in the Chamberlain-Conn Act. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that?
I see what they were trying to do. A lot of policing of people's bodies, but I see what they were trying to do from, like, a public health perspective.
The interesting thing to me about this is that, and I don't know what measures were taken before to treat STIs before this, like, act and all this kind of stuff, but it seems like a really big push. But the goal wasn't like, oh, the greater good of public health. The goal was like, we need soldiers to be healthy to fight this war. Mm-hmm. So I just think about all of the military dollars that, like, all the money that goes into the military, and sometimes it, like, kicks back and maybe does a good thing for the regular people, but it's really just, like, the intended goal is to, like, beef up the U.S. military.
Yeah, so that we can go out and terrorize other people. And I completely didn't even think about that, because I'm like, oh, they're thinking about what the soldiers are going to bring back. Nah, they're not even there.
Sis. Can this nigga shoot a gun?
He can if he's scratching his balls.
Or do he need penicillin? Exactly.
He can't focus. If it burns, we gotta pee.
Oh, poor thing. Yes. So ready for some of the real world impact. Yeah. Let's talk about the women. Mm-hmm. Or the people impacted. Under this law, women suspected to be...
I'm going to go back because also all of this came, like you said, I don't know how they're treating or addressing an STI or situations of STI in the U.S. and the homeland pre-war or during the war. But, like, all of this came from, like, xenophobia, like, what they heard of Europeans. Like, you don't even know what they're doing. This is rumors of what's happening in Europe. And you're like, oh, those people are diseased. We must protect our soldiers from catching them with their from their diseased women. Like,
that's a good point. Interesting. Yeah. All right. So under this law, women suspected to be sex workers could be stopped, detained, inspected, and could be sent to a rehabilitation center if they failed their examination. Any evidence of the disease found during any evidence of an STI found during one of these exams could constitute, quote unquote, proof of prostitution. By 1919, 30 states had constructed facilities for the purpose of detaining and treating women with STIs. An estimated 30,000 women were detained and examined during the war. During the course of the war, 110 red light districts throughout America were shut down. Despite these efforts, the availability of sex workers remained fairly constant around military camps, and rates of STIs remained quite high. So it didn't even work.
Well, of course it didn't even work, because there's so much emphasis on these women in being carriers of the disease of the STIs without putting any onus or accountability on these men who are also probably spreading the disease quicker if they're having multiple sex partners.
Mm-hmm. But also that's like an individual, either way, is an individual approach to a public health problem. Like, why didn't you guys give out condoms?
Why aren't we just loading up the soldiers for penicillin shots? They should be treated and detained, because you have greater control on them. They're already sexually...
I don't think that they should be detained, but I think everybody should be treated.
I don't mean, like, detained, but, like, you already have them... Quarantined? Yes, you already have them in one base. You know where they are, rather than going around and rounding up suspected people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Everybody should line up for their morning penicillin shots. You pee in a cup, you get shot. Like, right before breakfast, right before meth.
Yeah. I also don't know what the treatment was at that time, though. It's all very vague, like STIs, but I don't know which STIs we're talking about here.
There was no treatment. They was locking people up and forcing them to work. That's why we don't know.
I don't know if they were forcing them to work. There's no evidence of that yet. I don't know what those farm colonies were. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know what that means. Yeah, but this is just like when mass incarceration STI stigma links up.
Yeah, this is the crosshairs right there.
Nothing. and it just does nothing but traumatize people. Okay, let's get into some personal narratives. So first I want to say, if you want to find more about this wild time in American history, scholar Scott Stern wrote an entire book about the American plan. It's called The Trials of Nina McCall. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely adding it to my reading list. I haven't read it yet, but it's on my list. Mm-hmm. But Stern was also nice enough to write an entire article about this time for history, thehistorychannel.com. And it's called America's Forgotten Mass Imprisonment of Women Believed to Be Sexually Immoral. And I'm going to read a couple of passages from it. So first off, let's do a content warning for medical trauma for this first little section. Mm-hmm. So take, for example, this is Scott Stern's words. Take, for example, the nearly two dozen women rounded up by authorities on a single day in Sacramento in 1919. Margaret Hennessy, no relation, or maybe it is relation.
Okay.
Maybe she...
The family large. We don't know.
Was one of them, apprehended while walking her sister to the meat market. And it was just a regular meat market, not that kind of meat market. So there was nothing to suspect her. She was going to get food. It was a Tuesday, February 25th, a clear winter morning with a gentle wind and temperatures rising to the 40s and 50s. Hennessy, who lived in Richmond, California, with her husband, H.J., a Standard Oil foreman, had been staying in town recovering from influenza at the home of her sister, which is wild because she's like trying to like get well. She's actually trying to get well from a disease. And here you go, loop her in to put her into an institution where disease is more likely to spread. What has this country ever been doing? Blah, blah, blah. So known from press reports only as Miss Bradish. As the two women walked to the market, they were approached by an officer, Ryan, and other members of Sacramento's quote unquote moral squad, a unit formed that very morning tasked with... Right, it's already wild. Like, honestly, all of these history segments are just wild. Tasked with, quote unquote, cleansing the city of vice and immorality. The police told the two lone women they were under arrest as, quote unquote, suspicious characters. Miss Hennessy tried to explain who said she and what she was doing in Sacramento. She offered to show officers identification. She told the officers her 6-year-old son was attending school in a local convent, and if they arrested her, someone would have to take care of him. The officers, Hennessy later told the press, quote unquote, paid no heed but took my sister and I to the hospital. The moral squad delivered Hennessy and Bradish to the quote unquote Canary Cottage, as the city's isolation hospital was known. There, a doctor probed and prodded the two women's genitalia, examining them for sexually transmitted infections. At the hospital, I was forced to submit an examination just as if I was one of the most degraded women in the world. I want to say I have never been so humiliated in my life, Miss Hennessy told the local newspaper. My reputation means something to me, and I'm going to defend it.
Okay.
Any thoughts?
It really sounds like, well, one, it's wild that this force, this task was created that morning at 9 a.m. And niggas was like, all right, we outside. We got all the training we need.
And then like 2 hours later, taking women into the hospital. Like, damn.
They just hit the streets running. And
not even easing into the traumatization of people.
No, full force. They hit the feet on the ground running. And it sounds like they were targeted because they were two women walking around without a male chaperone, quote unquote. So that, of course, makes me immoral if there's no man around. He in the bed with influenza. We trying to get him some milk.
He needs some milk. Another thing that's interesting about that is, I thought that saying would more words would make my thought come back, but it didn't. Oh, okay. Miss Hennessy was able to go to the newspapers and speak up about it because she was like a middle class white woman. Mm-hmm. But imagine all of the, because even like her, like, oh, I felt like one of the most degraded women in the world. Who do you mean by that?
Okay.
who are the other most degraded women in the world? Yeah. So like she's able to like sound off and like get this voice in the newspaper. But think about all the other people who just had to take, and they were like, what the hell? Like, why am I going to the hospital?
And then, you know.
Like, imagine I'm walking to see you and I just get arrested.
Like, that's wild. And then being taken to this hospital and really being forced, you know, forced to do this examination that I'm truly not consenting to, but being coerced into because greater punishments lie on the other side if I don't you know, comply.
Right.
That's mad traumatizing.
Exactly. It's OD traumatizing. I would like you to look at and describe some propaganda from the time. Can you go to, can you go to, see it? Okay.
All right. Yep. So what we're looking at is a poster created by the American Social Hygiene Association warning soldiers of the dangers of prostitutes and STIs. Oh, wow. Okay.
It's pretty bad.
So in this poster, there is a soldier dressed in uniform, one woman labeled a prostitute, and then two femme figures that are actually skeletons that are labeled gonorrhea and syphilis luring in the background of this woman. So the man is labeled the young, the brave, the strong. Again, this woman is labeled a prostitute or prostitution. She is the whole embodiment of the institution of prostitution.
And she's kind of a bad bitch.
She is, though. Okay. Full titty, small waist, flowing gown, curls, beautiful gowns, like curls. But she is white.
She is white, yes.
And then, yes, these two femme figures, also femme presenting, labeled gonorrhea and syphilis. And then there's a poster in the back that says, two girls I know want to meet you in the worst way.
That sounds like a emo lyric from 2000.
Okay.
Sorry.
I was like, I feel like I heard that before. And I said,
in the worst way.
Mm-hmm. But yes, that's the poster.
But yeah, some blatant sexism. Mm-hmm. Some blatant blaming
because
of the women,
why is gonorrhea and syphilis femme?
Exactly. These are viruses. They don't have gender. They don't ascribe to the concept of gender. But imagine like gonorrhea virus that's just like wearing a dress. Just getting its makeup done. It's getting a beat.
I like it though.
Like, I too can be a bad bitch. But yeah. A little bit more about that day. That first day that Sacramento squad was opened, 22 other women were arrested, same day as Margaret Hennessy. Of the 22 women arrested for suspicions of STI, 16 were released later that day, including Hennessy and Bradish. 6 were held overnight, not allowed to speak with or contact anyone, which is horrifying. In the end, only one of the 22 women tested positive for STIs. In other words, the Sacramento Bee reported, out of 22 suspects subjected to an examination, the police were justified in arresting but one woman, which I don't think it was justified, but under the law, yes, it mm-hmm. was justified. Any thoughts about that?
That's wild. I can't. And it kind of it reminds me of like immigration policing, in that you're just picking people up for whatever you say, taking them to who knows where, not allowing them to contact people. Like, what? All for a law that probably the common person doesn't even know exists yet.
Yeah. It's, it reminds me of policing and incarceration in general.
In general,
right?
Yeah.
Like, stop and frisk, like, oh, you look black.
You look suspicious, you know, you look immoral. Yeah. That's coded. That is very coded.
Exactly. It also reminds me of, this is not on the books anymore. I don't know if it's because like there are things that are taken off the books and sometimes still practiced. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but officially it's not on the books anymore in New York. But the quote unquote walking while trans act, mm-hmm. where it's like if officers would see trans women, they would expect them to be sex workers, mm-hmm. and arrest them just on the suspicion that they were walking around while trans.
It's like, I'm going to the library, sir. Like, I'm minding my business.
Right. But then also like, sex work shouldn't be illegal. Exactly. So it's just like vice policing is so bad for many reasons. Like, you're profiling people, but you're also profiling people based on something that they shouldn't be in prison for.
It's the continuous, you know, dehumanization of people based on your perception of them, what you think, and, you know, because you have the law to back you up.
Exactly. Speaking of the law, let's get into some content warnings for police profiling and sexual violence, because shit gets bad, but not unlike things that we see today. Mm-hmm. So nearly every person examined and locked up under these laws were women. Mm-hmm. big surprise there. And the vague standard of quote unquote reasonable suspicion enabled officials to pretty much detain any woman they wanted. Mm-hmm. Records exist in archives that document women being detained and examined for sitting at a restaurant alone, for changing jobs, for being with a man, for walking down a street in a way a male official found suspicious, and often for no reason at all.
For changing jobs. So if I quit my job,
it's looking a little hoe-like. Like, it's giving hoe vibes.
It's giving hoe vibes. You don't know how to sit down at one job. You don't know how to commit. Like,
ladies, is it hoe to change your job? Okay.
Walking down the street in any way I found suspicious. So if I'm just here with a skip in my step, nah, she just got some dick. She's a little too happy. She's a little too happy. Exactly. Bring her in.
Exactly.
For being with a man. So like,
I guess, and he's not your husband? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have a ring or something like
or
that?
Or he's not identifiable family member.
Right,
so if exactly. I'm, if me and John just link up, you know, or if you're I'm home. Walking and John met home. Me, we were talking, you see us interacting, you're a hoe. You're soliciting. Gotcha. Exactly. Gotcha. Sitting at a restaurant alone, maybe I wanted a quick meal. Maybe I wanted to leave my motherfucking kids.
I love to eat at restaurants alone. Okay. It's like one of my favorite pastimes.
I left my kids at home. I just needed a break from the screaming kids. Went to a cute little IHOP and now I'm in jail. Okay. Wild. So just arrested for being a woman. Thank you. Okay.
Period. That's it. Period.
I need to be in the house and in my kitchen, barefoot and pregnant. Exactly. I can avoid these problems.
Exactly. Here's where it gets a little worse, but then also like when you say that, like, who had the opportunity to just be at home?
Exactly.
Sitting, doing nothing. White women. Middle-class white women. Mm-hmm. Who had to be out. Who had to be alone.
Working class. And poor women. Like,
right. Here's where it gets really bad. Many women were also detained if they refused to have sex with police or health officers.
Oh, Father God.
Contemporaneous exposés reveal. In the late 1940s, San Francisco police officers sometimes threatened to have women vagged, quote unquote, or vaginally examined if they didn't accede to sexual demands. Women of color and immigrant women, as we just alluded to, in particular, were targeted and subjected to a higher degree of abuse once they were locked up.
So your job is to be sniffing the streets, supposedly identifying people who may have STIs to bring them in for treatment, and you go, no, we just picking people to fuck.
Exactly. So it's like the nature of the program didn't work in the first place, mm-hmm. because incarcerating people is not the way that you help the public health issues. But then because you're baking in this inherent like structure mm-hmm. of hierarchy of power, you're just putting you're giving these people who are enforcing the power no actual like reason to like do good, mm-hmm. and you're giving the people who are on the other end of power just like you're putting them in a hyper vulnerable situation. So you're just not helping.
Just not. And then it's like you as a police officer saying, either I can rape you or can have you medically raped. Like, which one would you prefer?
Exactly. That is really it.
So really the option you gave me was rape. Gotcha.
That is exactly it. That is exactly it. So in summation from Stearns's piece in the History Channel website, enforcement of the American plan ended in the 1970s, which is not all that far away.
My God, the 70s.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Amid the rise of the civil rights movement, the women's lib movement, and the sex workers' rights movement, it had lasted in many places half a century, but today, half a century later, few people have ever heard of it. I had not heard of it. Mm-hmm. Even fewer are aware that the American plan laws, the ones passed in the late 1910s, enabling officials to examine people for merely reasonably suspected of having STIs, are still on the books in some form in every state in the nation. Some of these laws have been altered or amended, and some have been absorbed into broader public health statutes. But each state still has the power to examine reasonably suspected people and isolate the infected ones if health officials deem such isolation necessary.
Wow. That's scary.
That's where we're at, yo.
That's scary.
That's where we're at. Yeah, it's interesting to me how like practices in things like this and policing existed not that long ago, because when 1910s, that's not that long ago. Mm-mm. That's like 110 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then like the public consciousness of it is completely like devoid. We have no consciousness of it. Mm-hmm. But then it's like still,
it's lingering baked in the background. Into the way. Yeah,
exactly.
It's yeah. Baked into the legal fabric of this country.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And something rooted in not even a good idea
to begin with. Because it didn't work.
Just have these bad vestiges of, it's like, you know, like how we don't need, was it? We don't need our spleen or something mm-hmm. like that. But it's not hurting us. It's like we have a whole bunch of bad spleens.
Yeah, we have a whole bunch of spleens in our system. And then it's like you have to fight to get it forcibly removed. Because they'll mm-hmm. sit and tell you, oh, but it's not hurting anyone. It don't need to be here.
It don't need to be here.
It don't need to be here.
It's not helping anyone. Yeah. Any thoughts about that?
My mind's gonna take some time to process that, because that's wild. I'm mind blown.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick break to process. And then after we do that quick break, Professor Akua is going to take over with some LGBTQ biology, which I think will be a good palate cleanser from that. All right, as some of you may have already heard, this season is the last season of Inner Hoa Uprising, but turn that frown upside down and buckle up, because from now until the end of November, you're in store for the last dance, the final hoorah, the final countdown, our swan song, the last act, our farewell appearance, our famous last words, the culmination. It's gonna be good. If you have special memories or moments of IHU that you'd like to share with us, drop us a line. It'll make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside, and we'll play them on our final episode. To share your thoughts, leave a voicemail to 404-491-9158. Give you a moment to pull out your phone, open your little notes app or your little text message app so you can write down that number. There's your moment. 404-491-9158. That number will also be in the show notes. Thanks for rocking with us for 10 seasons. Let's get back to the show. Let's start with our segment, Animals Do Be Gay, though.
He humped a male dog. The owner said, "This dog must be gay."
Where we acknowledge and discuss the diverse sexual identities of animals, non-human animals. What's up? What's going on, Professor Akua?
Well, first, I wanted to give y'all a sneak peek into my life and introduce you to the gay animals in my very own household. They're nice. A little frisky, so now I gotta go get them. Please hold. I am back. You can see my kitty, Sim Sim.
Hi, Sim Sim.
His name is Simba. But I call him Sim Sim or Dim Sum or my little alley cat. He for the streets. But this is Simba. Come on in. And then this is Milo.
Oh, hi, Milo.
Milo Oliver. So Milo is my partner Ivan's emotional support animal. Oh, he's doing. Oh. Stop sniffing him like that. Boundaries. And I got Simba in June of this year from a family friend. Mm-hmm. So in putting them together, we first noticed some aggressive behaviors in putting two male cats together. But now we mm-hmm. notice some very bi-curious behaviors. So Simba, ooh-oh. Who's the suspected kitty, my little gay baby, after being first aggressive with Milo, they got more familiar with each other. Simba will now like be all up in his space. So he'll be smelling the genital area. He'll be smelling his butt. And when he gets very aggressive, he'll pounce or mount on Milo, which then turns into a fight because Milo's like, back up. You don't know me like that. But when they're really good together, like if Milo's chilling, Simba will walk up to him and start kissing him. Just start like licking him all over the face. Aww. And Milo will sit for it because he likes attention from anyone. He's a little attention whore. But when it gets too much for him, they then start fighting again.
So interesting.
We're trying to teach Simba that he can show affection, but also learn consent and boundaries, because he just be all up on this space. So you'll hear me yelling at them like, don't sniff him like that, or get off of him because he will mount him.
Okay. Interesting, interesting.
Oh, my little gay babies. Milo himself has quite a gaydar. He does not like cis men. If you are cis, you are queer, and that's only.
Wait, so he has a transdar? Is that what it is?
I guess.
Or is it?
if you're cis, you have to be queer, and he really takes.
He just has an LGBTQ, queerdar, yes. Period. Gotcha. Okay,
that's good to know. If you're a straight cis man, he's not rocking with you. He's running. Like, he runs and he hides.
It's valid.
Oh, now they're both playing. I wish you guys can see them. All right, so those are the gay animals in my home. Let's talk about
Animals. Thank you for giving us that peek into the very queer household that you're running over there.
Okay, because we queer as hell over
here. It's a gay cat house.
I'm queer. My partner's queer. My son is queer. My cats are queer. Next is going to be plants. Like, I ain't got nothing else.
Wonderful. We love to see it.
Next, we will talk about some bisexual polycule ostriches.
Love it.
Now, it seems that most ostriches are bisexual and polycule. That's just the nature of how they interact with each other. So apparently a courtship will, the ostrich species is a bisexual and complex group. The courtship will start with one male to one female ostrich. Mm-hmm. And once they cohabitate, once they reproduce, the ostrich will get another. So you'll see an ostrich with about at least three female companions. And they live in this. They have like kitchen table poly, like they together.
Nice.
So he'll choose between 3 to 5 hens or female ostriches to mate with. Once they mate, they start to hold their eggs together. So he'll mate with all 3 to 5. They'll start to lay eggs and they'll have their legs in a communal nest. So all of his eggs are in one nest. And that's like 15 to 60 eggs. Like, that's a lot of eggs. But also what I think it's, and then once the baby ostriches hatch, they kind of raise and protect them together. Like, everyone, parents or just other outside ostriches and other groups, like, look out for the little baby ostriches till they're big and strong and can, you know, carry themselves.
That's sweet.
And even the caring for, what I like is that the caring, the child rearing, isn't gendered, is equitable. So during the day, because what we know as ostriches, when you typically see a picture, you're probably seeing a male ostrich with the black, tall black ostrich with black feathers and white tips. Those are male ostriches. Female ostriches are like our light brown, a little bit smaller, still big as fuck, but a little bit smaller.
Yes. So Akua knows she got punched in the face by one of the summer.
Okay. We might use that picture as the
That's a good idea.
So during the day, the female ostriches will lay on the eggs, incubate them, care for them because they match the soil to their surroundings. So they can sit and kind of camouflage the eggs. At night, the males will sit and watch them because they can camouflage them underneath their black feathers. And I thought that was so cool. And it seems that even the women will interact sexually with the other female because it
Miss Mama,
it ensures their survival. They're able, like, having that community and make sure that they're able to get enough water and nutrients. So like, they're like, I'm here for me. I'm here to make sure I get the best end out of this deal. The more people around, the better.
Interesting. I dig it. Makes sense to me.
I love it.
Look at nature
doing the thing. So that is ostriches. To learn more about other, you know, potentially bisexual, polycule, or queer family orientations, there is a book out, or if you want to help your children learn about this, because I'm going to get this book. There is a book out that is designed to be teenage friendly and to talk about queer animals in nature. So this book is written by Elliot Schrafer. It is a book filled with comics and humor that makes science accessible and speaks about the diversity of sexual behavior in the animal world. I don't know why I don't have the name of this book. Sam, can you pull out the name of this book? I didn't put it in my notes.
The book is called Queer Ducks and Other Animals, The Natural World of Animal Sexuality.
Yes. So each chapter is structured around a different animal accompanied by a one-page comic. And the comics are funny as fuck, actually. So y'all need to check that out. And Schrafer said that he wrote this book because he didn't see something like this in his childhood, but he also wanted to change the narrative of that scientific writing only had to be for academic purposes. So there's a few quotes for him that I pulled that I enjoyed. The first one is, "I'm not trying to argue for human behaviors that differ from certain ways that animals can behave. Instead, I'm trying to say that we can no longer argue that humans are alone in their queerness or in their LGBTQ identities. Instead, we are part of a million of years tradition within the animal world of a variety of approaches to sex and a ton of advantages that come around from it." He also says, "I think there's a loneliness to human queerness, that there is this idea that is something that happened recently to the species and that we are alone in it. That queer people can find each other and find community with each other, and that is the goal that we should hope for when we are heavily integrated into the natural world. And that is the part of the message that I think is lost, and that LGBTQ behaviors and identities are absolutely natural."
Love it.
I love it.
Love it.
Y'all go out there, cop that man book. I'm going to get one for Dave.
I want a book too.
Because it's funny. I saw some of the comics and I cackled.
That's cute. That's cute.
All right.
You going to do this gay goose thing or should I go into...
No, I'm going to do this gay goose thing.
Okay.
Cool. Because this is a story of love, scandal, mistaken identity, and kidnapping.
Oh my God. I read this story. The soaps.
And I said, oh shit, this is entertaining. So according to Sam's note, this happened in 2018. And then again, went viral in 2020 for some reason. That's just the nature of the internet. Things circle back and we pick back up on them.
Yes.
But this actually all started, this is a 90s love story, y'all. This all started around 1990 when a black swan named Henrietta flew into the Waimanu Lagoon, which is located in a small town on New Zealand's Kapiti Coast. So it started in 1990 with a black swan named Henrietta. Henrietta had a damaged wing, so she was unable to fly with the other swans and was often left alone. You know, when they picked up and went, Henrietta couldn't follow. She couldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the pattern until a few years later in the 90s when a white goose named Thomas arrived. They quickly formed a bond, and Thomas was very protective of Henrietta, even scaring away any humans or dogs that came near her. He was like, this is my girl. Back up.
Mm, right? Okay. And that energy.
Okay. Love it. And they were happy and together for 18 full years, right? 18 full years. So after 18 years, a new young female swan entered the equation and was often spotted with Henrietta. No one thought much of it because they assumed both of them were female. The shocker came when the new swan laid an egg, and it turned out that Henrietta was in fact a male swan who had mated with this new young swan. So they went to change Henrietta's name. Henrietta was renamed Henry, and they gave the new young swan the name Henrietta. So now we have Henrietta, we have Henry, they got a baby, and we got Thomas. Mm-hmm. So Thomas was like, what the fuck? Like, how you gonna come in and steal my person, right? So this was when Thomas's tea spilled out. They were like, oh, he's really swinging the other way. He really likes Henry. All this time, we thought this was Henrietta. We assumed, because this is what we're doing. We assuming.
They outed Thomas.
They outed Thomas. Or Henrietta's, Henry's, I don't want to call it adultery, but stepping out and outed them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Henrietta, Thomas was not happy. He was really aggressive, started beating them up. He was not happy with Henry or the new Henrietta. He was not feeling it at all. He was like, we gotta square the fuck up because you out here cheating. You done came and stole my nigga. Not doing this with y'all.
This is a love and hip hop episode.
Okay. So it was beef. It was tensions were high. There was beef. But then the babies came, the eggs hatched, and Thomas warmed up. He completely changed and took those babies right underneath his wing and cared for them like they were his own. So Henry, formerly Henrietta, and Henrietta the new swan, went on to have 68 babies over the next year. They kept reproducing. And Thomas decided to stick around where he played like a doting uncle. He helped raise their babies, taught them to fly, was taking care of them when their parents weren't around. Thomas was like, we're just going to be one big happy family. These are my cute, kids.
Yes. Uh-huh.
In 2009, Henry the Black Swan died from old age. And then Henrietta, I don't really like Henrietta. I'm not a side chick kind of person. I have my contentions. But Henry died and Henrietta flew off with another bird and just left Thomas. Girl, he done raised your babies.
She's a deadbeat mom.
It was just gone, okay? Flew off with another bird and just left Thomas. Thomas, mm-hmm. however, went on to meet a female goose and had his own 10 little babies.
That's cute.
So he met another goose, had his own babies because his partner died. This girl left, the other partner in the throuple. Yep, his metamorph left. So he moved on with life, had his 10 whole babies. But then some other goose came and stole his babies.
What the fuck?
Some other random ass goose came and took his babies.
And stole Thomas, all of his children?
All his children. All 10 of his children. And then raised his babies by himself. Just came and snatched them right out the hospital.
Is Thomas alive still?
Well, Thomas died in 2019. That's when it
So this was published about Thomas.
This was Thomas's biography.
He had a hard life. That is a wild ride. And he died alone. I'm really sad about that.
He died alone. Yeah.
Oh, RIP to my boy Thomas.
Okay, and an LGBTQ icon in the country of New Zealand. They love him over there. They were mourning him when he passed. But he lived, much like a lot of our queer ancestors, lived a wild life. Okay.
Very complicated.
Wild life. But that is the story of Thomas, a little bisexual goose.
I like that.
Oh, also, no, he was also blind towards the end of his life. He started to lose his eyesight, really got, due to aging and stuff, and then he passed away.
Do you remember the story about the tortoise?
Yes.
It's very similar. I think it was also New Zealand, gay polyamorous and then that tortoise went blind and then he died. The fuck is going on in New Zealand?
I think some old gay age, shit your water. Eyesight just starts to go.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. it's the very famous gay animals though.
Mm-hmm. And I think what was with the tortoise was that he was blind but he was still getting it on. He was like, I'm old.
Oh yeah, he was fucking
but
yes.
We fucking still. He had multiple burns, I don't need my eyes to see what we doing.
Ooh, love to see it. Okay, that was fun. That was a good professor. That was a good biology class, professor.
Thank you. Learn about the diversity of these birds.
I love it. Yeah, there's a lot of gay birds. All right, shall we go back to hoe history before we wrap up?
Yes.
Are you a hoe?
Take me back.
All right, I'm gonna take you back to some very interesting shit in the age of white men. It's still the age of white men, but the golden age of white men just doing shit and calling it science.
And I want to say that Sam has a lot of this redacted, so I'm going to be hearing this fresh and new with y'all. Yes. So let's get into it.
All right. So this next section, I'm going to read a piece in McGill Journal in the history section written by Joe Schwartz, PhD, on March 20th, 2017. So the piece is entitled Getting Steinached Was All the Rage in the Roaring 20s. And my question offered for a quiz, any hypothesis on what getting steinached means?
Nah, like I don't even Steinach sounds like a, I was going to say, it sounds like a Jewish last name. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm working on myself.
Well, no, that's fine. Okay. I think that that's valid. That's valid. So, because someone named Stein does come into play, yes.
Okay. But I don't know what possibly they tend to be doing. So I'm interested because let me hear what y'all was doing.
Okay, let me continue. So let me just unredact this. Okay. In Vienna, there was another kind of roar. So this is taking place during the 20th century, the roaring 20s, the 1920s. In Vienna, there was another kind of roar. It was emanating from thousands of older men who claimed to have regained their virility through what seemed to be a stunning advance in medicine. They had been Steinached. Mm-hmm. Any guess now?
They've gained their virility advancement. They have them doing something weird. Let's find out. I don't even know. Because okay. The 20s at that? Nah, I can't guess. I just...
Okay. The men had undergone a 20-minute procedure introduced by Eugene Steinach, in which one of their seminal ducts was tied off. In other words, the men underwent a partial vasectomy. The goal wasn't prevention of pregnancies. It was...
to get them to come harder.
Or have, I think that that's a part of it.
Seminal ejaculation.
That's definitely a part of it. But they called it, in general, rejuvenation. Uh-huh. And the backstory behind it is very fucking wild. So you ready to go on a journey?
I'm ready.
Right. Let's go on a journey. All right. Steinach's work was stimulated by French physiologist Charles Edouard Brown Sequard.
That's a name, okay?
Very fucking French. And his seminal lecture delivered to members of the La Société de Biologie in 1899, in which he described, are you ready? Put on your fucking seatbelt.
I'm on.
Having injected himself with filtered extracts from the crushed testicles of young dogs and guinea pigs to regain the vigor and intellectual stamina of his youth.
See. The fuck is y'all talking about? Okay.
The professor had also tested himself with a dynamometer, a device that measures mechanical force, and found that his muscle strength had also been renewed. He capped off the lecture by telling his rapt audience that just hours earlier, he had passed the final test of his experiment by, quote unquote, paying a visit to his young wife, meaning they fucked. And yeah. He fucks very well because he injected himself with dog balls.
I don't even believe that. Let me hear his wife's side. Because let me hear what his wife had to say about that episode, about that visit. Because
first of all, if you're injecting yourself with dog balls, don't have sex with me.
Oh, like don't call me like, with need that.
You need to tell me that first. Because like I don't know.
I don't even know what's going to happen. What are you bringing to me?
Exactly. Like, zoonotic diseases exist. So what the fuck are you trying to pass? Nigga made COVID 1899 or some shit like that.
He passed the final test and his wife was like, that was the worst sex we ever had. I didn't even think it could get worse. Just exactly. A waste of my goddamn time.
Exactly. This is also the era of women just probably lying.
Oh yeah.
Like, yeah, it was so great.
Wonderful.
She's like, let me call my side chick. All right, let me unredact this section and get into it. But yeah, so this guy Sequard is who Steinach is in part fucking inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
So the scientific community, however, did not buy Brown Sequard's claim that the key to rejuvenation was injection of minced gonads. That's crazy. Words you thought you'd never say. Minced gonads. The prestigious Boston Medical and Surgical Journal opined that the sooner the general public, and especially septuagenarian, that's like 70 years and up, readers of the latest sensation understand that for the physically used up and worn out, there is no secret rejuvenation, no elixir of youth, the better. Mm-hmm. Biology professor Eugene Steinach, however, thought Brown Sequard's work with gonads was worth pursuing and turned into transplanting the testes of male guinea pig into a female. She then exhibited mounting behavior characteristic of a male. Steinach concluded that the gland secretions were responsible for sexuality and even theorized that homosexuality in men could be quote-unquote treated by transplanting a testicle from a quote-unquote normal man, a straight man, into a recipient in need of, or a heterosexual man, into a recipient in need of quote-unquote remasculinization.
No.
Thankfully, that idea didn't fly. Because what the fuck are we talking about here? What are y'all niggas talking about? But surgeon Serge Voronoff's notion of grafting monkey gland tissues onto testicles of aging men did. Are you ready for Voronoff?
Mm-hmm.
While serving as physician to the king of Egypt, Voronoff had noted that the court eunuchs, that's people who have been castrated for, I think, like, faith reasons, were often sickly and seemed to age very quickly. Mm-hmm. The testes, he concluded, played an important role in maintaining vigor, and that quote-unquote possession of active genital glands was the best possible assurance for a long life.
Okay.
In 1918, he believed he made his point when he restored an aging ram's youthful vitality by transplanting the testes of a young lamb. Thoughts about that?
I understand that this was what we know of science today. It's not what they knew then. And I mean, it again goes back to this obsession of like male sexuality. And yes. But also this obsession that they had in the past of like youthfulness. And it's like, mm-hmm. we're all going to die one day. We can't prevent it. We're all going to go. But you're going to extreme lengths to continue to be this young buck, so to speak.
It's also like not looking at any other surrounding factors. So like maybe eunuchs were sickly and dying faster because they were like mutilated against their will.
Okay.
They were young boys. Or maybe because they like spent their like, oh, the eunuchs are so much more like weak and tired than the king, because the king sits up there and gets people fucking to serve him shit all day. Like, these niggas are working.
Exactly. And maybe they're not even looking into the living and social conditions of the eunuchs. Maybe they're just eating one meal a day and barely drink water.
Like. Exactly.
And they're exactly. like, no, they don't got no testes. That's the issue.
Exactly. I just want to note this also happened in 1918, same time as the American plan. That was a bad time. If anybody ever invents time travel, like obviously don't go back to slavery back. Times, but don't go back to 1918.
1918, Sam?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. It's bad.
That's the other day. Like,
that is the other day. That is the other day. Exactly. Exactly. I have a little bit more about that later.
All right.
About like today. But incarceration comes back up.
Oh, child.
So let's talk about that. Voronoff upped the ante by transplanting the testes of executed criminals into aging men rich enough to pay for the procedure.
Oh.
Is that not some American horror story shit?
Yeah.
That is something that actually happened in this world.
In this world. They said, after execution, not pass their give me organs. Balls.
Give me them balls, bro. But demand soon outstripped supply, which I would hope so. It's actually bad either way.
Well, yes.
Because why are that many people asking for executed people's balls?
Because they want to be young, viral men.
Demand soon outstripped supply, and since few young men were willing to take part with their precious parts, even for rich compensation, Voronoff came up with an alternative scheme. He would transplant bits of chimpanzee and monkey testes into the genitals of elderly men. He would transplant... Eventually, more than 1,000 men underwent the monkey gland treatment at the hands of doctors around the world, with the requisite material often being supplied by a monkey farm Voronoff set up in the Italian Riviera.
Wait a minute. Wow. I'm hoping and I'm assuming that they were told that this was monkey, you know, this was materials for monkeys.
I would hope so.
Okay.
I would hope so. I don't know. None of it's good science. So
yeah, none of it is good science.
I don't know if informed consent was a thing. Oh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Cause like the whatchamacallit, the executed people, did they, like, you know how you have to like sign for like organ donation?
I know they didn't.
Except for that to be done to their balls after they died or were killed by the state. All right. So Steinach actually comes back into play and he tones things down a bit. So his procedure does not include injecting monkey balls. Steinach bought Voronoff's idea, but thought the benefits ascribed to the transplants could be achieved by an alternate procedure. Damming the seminal canal would stimulate the testes to produce more male hormones, he thought. At the time, researchers had determined that there were two types of tissues in the testicle, seminal tubules produced by spermatozoa, but there were also Leydig cells between the tubules that release sex hormones. Steinach's idea was that the two types of tissues compete for nourishment and that stifling the sperm production tissue, producing tissues, would boost the production of the sex hormones. In his book, Sex and Life, Steinach described how his patients changed from quote-unquote feeble, parched, dribbling drones to young men of vigorous bloom who threw away their glasses. That is, like, shut up. Shut up. I'm cured! Like, ooh. Shut up. Threw away their glasses, shaved twice a day, and dragged loads up to 220 pounds.
No.
And even, exactly, indulged in such youthful follies as buying land in Florida. What are you talking about? Is this why Florida is not a good place today? This is where they all went.
These are the descendants of the people from 1918. But yes, they were like, oh, they're exploring new lands. They're entrepreneurs.
Ugh. He believed in his procedure so strongly that he thrice reactivated himself. It isn't clear what he meant by thrice, because once the duct is tied off, it's tied off. That's a really great point. What is he talking about? He doesn't have three testicles. Or maybe I don't know. I don't know what's going on. Whatever improvement Steinach and his patients felt was probably due to wishful thinking, because as we know now, vasectomies do not boost hormonal output by the testes. Steinach had testimonials galore, including from some very, very famous people, such as Sigmund Freud, who underwent the procedure when he was 67 years old, hoping to improve his sexuality, his general condition, and his capacity for work. You don't need no capacity for work. You're 67.
Okay.
Hang it up, flat screen, like, retire. William Butler Yeats, the famed writer, was Steinach when he was 69. He said, it revived my creative power in 1937. Apparently, in more than one way, the doctor who performed the ship invited a woman half Yeats age to dinner with the aim of allowing the writer to make a connection and test out his newly embellished virility. It seems the outcome was successful, with Yeats publicly reporting on his quote-unquote second puberty, leading to the Dublin press nicknaming him the gland old man. Anything to say?
This is wild. Again, there's just this staunch idea for like youth, mm-hmm. rather than retirement. Like, it's okay, you have done your thing. And is this sex for sex sake? Is this reproduction? Like, are you trying to have children at 69? Like, what is the need for sexual stamina and prowess?
I think it's internalized ageism.
Like, just get to making love and enjoy yourself. Like, and the need to always pursue like young women. Y'all weren't satisfying nobody, young or old. Like, they were all annoyed.
Yeah, it's like I need to be a spry young buck kind of thing, as opposed to I need to live a happy and fulfilled life or be a contributing member to society kind of thing. Also, the part where it was like feeble and stuff like that, that's like the feeble-minded thing, that's like the inherent ableism at the time.
This is the
era where people would just like straight up, oh, like, you're going to an institution because we do not deem you to have a high IQ or whatever. and all that kind of shit. So that all definitely looped up a lot in the early 20th century, in that whole pseudoscience era. All right, let's wrap up with the conclusion and wrap up this episode pretty quickly. While it is now clear that Brown, Sequard, Varnoff, and Steinach promoted procedures that did not have the claimed efficacy, they did lay the foundations for further research that resulted in the isolation of testosterone, the male hormone. Mm-hmm. I don't know if these other studies, yeah, I don't know what came of them, so I'm not going to read that part. But yeah, it laid their foundation for some stuff. Final thoughts?
History is an interesting time.
And it's not even like ancient history. This is like 100-something years ago. Recent, it's not that far away.
Like, yeah, I'm thinking we're talking history. About the 1818-somethings, and Sam said no, the good old 1900s, sis.
Brown Sequard's thing was 1899.
That's
right around the corner.
That's wild. But yeah, nothing surprises me. People will go to extreme lengths to not fall into categories of the oppressed. And this continues to show.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a really good way to sum it up. So I actually, since we're plugging so many books this episode, I actually learned about the Steinach procedure and Sequard's weird semen thing in this book that I was reading over the summer called Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography by Rebecca M. Jordan Young and Katrina Karkazis. It examines how our cultural understanding of testosterone has led to some shoddy scientific understandings of testosterone. One chapter that I thought was really interesting was the common narratives around testosterone and aggression, like T inherently makes people aggressive, is rooted in some very, very flawed studies and some very shoddy science. Mm-hmm. Like one of the studies, it was like, because you have to like paint your parameters, right? You have to say like, how are we, aggression is such a broad thing. How are we defining aggression? So they looked at it in like, young boys who were in like juvenile detention, and one of the aggressive behaviors, quote unquote, was running away from juvenile detention.
Ma'am.
It's like, who the fuck wouldn't want to do that? Who wants to be there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The idea of not complying to a higher authority is aggression. No, it's human nature, my nigga. I don't want to be here.
Right. But then also, if you're an oppressed person, not complying to authority is aggressive behavior. But if you're the oppressor, then not complying is also an aggressive behavior. And one is like colored as good and one is colored as bad.
Even like thinking about how enslaved people would be labeled aggressive because they didn't want to stay in captivity, like, nigga, no. Exactly. It's not aggression. I'm fighting for my life. Like, I gotta go. It's not where
exactly. It's all looped up in racism, ain't it? And the other isms. Okay, final thoughts on any of that whole history before we wrap up the episode.
I learned a lot today.
More than you wanted to know, huh? Okay. A little bit more than you wanted.
Because I didn't know what getting Steinach was. I thought it involved some alcohol. I was very wrong.
Well, let's wrap up the episode. If this podcast has ever in your whole life made you laugh, helped you learn something, made you feel good, made you question yourself in a good way, or positively moved you in any sense, please leave us a voicemail for our series finale. If you have special memories or moments of Inner Hoe Uprising that you like to share with us, drop us a line. It'll make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside, as I said, and we will play it on the final episode. To share your thoughts, you can leave a voicemail to 404-491-9158. Again, that is 404-491-9158. That number will be in the show notes. Have a lovely week, because you motherfucking deserve to. Bye-bye.
Bye.